Chapter 9. Tor and Citizen Lab. At DEF CON back in 2001, as the Cult of the Dead Cow panel focused on hacktivism and touted the spin-off Hacktivismo, the group also announced what it said would be its first tool for evading government censorship. Dubbed Peekabooty, the idea was complex. Users in free countries could install the software and then serve as intermediaries for people behind national firewalls in China or elsewhere, who might not be able to reach forbidden religious, news, or other websites directly. They could contact the volunteers running Peekabooty, who would not be blocked, and the volunteers could automatically route the desired content to them over the commonplace Secure Locket's Lair encryption, used at sites whose web address begins with HTTPS. The authorities would not be able to read any traffic, and they would not be alarmed because it would look like an ordinary encrypted business transaction. Though the BBC had reported that the open source project would be unleashed at DEF CON, it was not ready for release. Laird Brown was hoping the advanced publicity would attract more volunteers whom he could assign to different aspects of the job. The lead programmer to emerge and labor full-time on the task was software developer Paul Baranowski, who worked with Laird at Toronto startup OpenCola. But Baranowski grew annoyed that Laird couldn't find other programmers, and he and friend Joey Davila left Hacktivismo with the code. They released it on their own at a San Francisco conference in February 2002. Hacktivismo is good with thinking up new projects, but not with follow-through, Baranowski said. But they didn't get critical mass either. Peekabooty's most valuable contribution was to say, hey, this kind of thing is possible. Here's an idea, go run with it, Davila said. Its truest value was as a proof of concept. In 2004, Laird announced what he called the 6-4 system, a reference to the June 4, 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. Written by incoming CDC member Kamal Ackman, a talented German hacker with the handle Mixter, 6-4 was another serious try at a safe network of proxies. I thought subverting totalitarian governments was cool, Kamal said. CDC was making the most of its publicity for something positive. Kamal spent more than a year getting 6-4 to a point where it could be published for others to build on. But Hacktivismo's mailing list still only had about 20 active members and perhaps 200 lurkers. Like Baranowski's earlier attempt, 6-4 failed to thrive in the wild. All the same, Hacktivismo's very public attempts to provide free secure web tools for the hundreds of millions of people under severe government scrutiny and restrictions inspired other programmers who got the job done. It turned out they didn't need to invent a new tool, just revise an old one. Back in the mid-90s, three men at the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory had come up with the idea of bouncing internet traffic from one server to another to a third to keep both ends anonymous from snoops in the middle. The first node would know only where the initial contact had come from, and after opening the first layer of the message, where to send the rest of the content. The second would know only that it had heard from the first node, and that the content needed to go to a third node. And the third node would know the final content and who outside the network should receive it. No one would know both the content and the sender. Because this multi-step unpeeling resembled an onion, the project became known as the Onion Router, later abbreviated as Tor. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, provided new funding in 1997, seizing on the effort as a way to protect U.S. military and other undercover officials from being identified as they investigated online. To the government, though, this system had a fatal flaw. Anyone who was contacted via Tor would know a Fed was knocking on the door. But one of the original Navy trio, mathematician Paul Siverson, along with new collaborators Roger Dingledine and Nick Mathewson, discovered a way to make it appealing enough that people outside the government would use it too, effectively hiding the agents in the crowd. They completed a prototype in September 2002, 7 months after Peekabooty code came out, and released a version of Tor to the public the following year. Pika Booty and 6-4 were major influences on Tor. One of the strongest ways that Pika Booty influenced Tor was in pushing us to make good, clear specifications of how Tor works and what it tries to achieve, Dingledine said. In addition, he said, Pika Booty was years ahead of Tor in resisting censorship instead of just preserving anonymity. In 2004, craving funding from an outside and non-governmental source, the Tor project sought and won a grant from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, whose lawyers had already been involved in efforts by CDC and Hacktivismo. The EFF's support in turn helped Tor get money from Human Rights Watch, Google, and other parts of the federal government. Among other things, the early competition from Hacktivismo showed potential funders that there was a real demand for anonymity services, and that activists independent of the government wanted to provide it. We saw them as a key part of our constituency and fellow travelers. Then EFF legal director and future executive director Cindy Cohn said of CDC, these folks were trying to support the use of technology, sometimes really advanced stuff, to empower users and make social and political change. That's what we believed in, too. The friendly competition continued to the good of the users. In 2006, Hacktivismo and a Texas CDC Ninja Strike Force member named Steve Toplitz released the most popular of the group's anonymous tools, another try at a protected browser called Zero Bank, or XB. This one was designed to work with Tor, which at that point allowed for computer-to-computer connections, email, and other services, but not easy web surfing. This browser was a modified version of Firefox that could work from a USB stick. That meant it could go with the user to a public computer and leave no trace. Once again, by publicly working on a safe browser, Hacktivismo prodded Tor along. Tor released its own browser as part of a bundle, making it far more usable. By 2006, more users were relying on Tor to evade censorship, not to stay anonymous, and China had become the third largest market, with about 10,000 daily users. In 2006, Laird organized a conference on wireless technology in Dharamsala, India, the seat of the exiled Tibetan government. That helped establish the area as a place for idealistic developers to work. Laird moved to the city in 2009, and spent 3 years there helping the community without pay. He worked on security in the Dalai Lama's office and helped build up local expertise. Then he spent 2 more years in Bangalore at an internet policy nonprofit. Hacktivismo inspired hundreds or thousands of individuals and groups. Many had stories like Nathan Freitas's. A New York tech worker at the turn of the millennium, Freitas first heard about Tibetan repression from concerts headlined by the Beastie Boys. Through a work acquaintance in the late 1990s, he stumbled across a tiny Tibetan group in the Hell's Kitchen neighborhood that had only one modem and needed assistance setting up an office network. He did that, then noticed that there were viruses on virtually every machine. He realized that the Tibetans were under constant attack by the Chinese government. In 2004, Freitas had to make a choice. The small startup he helped found had been acquired by Palm, the smartphone pioneer, years before. Now Palm wanted to promote him and move him to Silicon Valley. But if he took that promotion, he'd be too busy for part-time activism. Freitas looked at what the hackers in CDC had been able to do. They were hilarious, interesting, and effective, he said. They showed that small groups could impact nation, state, or global corporate policies. It was CDC that made me say, maybe I can bring these things together. Freitas quit Palm and used money from the acquisition to turn to hacktivism full-time. He went to China for a month with equipment to figure out how shortwave radio was being blocked and how to protect it. Then he helped start Tibet Action Institute with students for a free Tibet leader, Ladon Tetong, providing technical help and security advice to emigrants around the world. In the run-up to the Beijing Olympics in 2008, Freitas set up the satellite video feed to a publicly viewable website for a protest from the base camp on Mount Everest. The higher-profile activism brought more sophisticated cyber attacks from China, which just hardened his resolve. In just 2008, he equipped 70 people, many inside the mainland, with $3,000 crypto phones, burner phones, and netbooks. Freitas went to Dharamsala in 2008 to train Tibetans and met up with Laird. He had this monk-like status, but he was this big, tall, Canadian white guy, Freitas said. Laird coached Freitas and helped brainstorm about how to accomplish more with less. And he introduced Freitas to his world of contacts. When Google launched Android, Freitas jumped to use it for making a secure phone more cheaply. Eventually, he masterminded a version of Tor for the phones. Since then, his program has been downloaded 17 million times, and he now heads all of Tor's mobile offerings. Laird also inspired what many independent security experts consider the best model for researching and exposing government use of the Internet for repression, the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs. It started with a University of Toronto student, Nart Villeneuve, all the way back in 2001. He had read CDC text files and was following along when the group launched Hacktivismo, soon joining that mailing list. Inspired, he launched a modest website tracking various hacktivism efforts, and he interviewed Laird for a text file of his own. When I was starting out, I sort of became attracted to the mythical hacker archetype who could do everything, Villeneuve said. Without a technical background, he was interested in traditional politics and protests. Initially, disruptive tactics like web defacements and denial-of-service attacks made sense to him. But Laird's writing took him toward a more constructive side of things, he said, including getting around censorship. At the time, people in China were complaining that they couldn't see some of the web, but there was no data about what was off limits. Villeneuve came up with a way to test for website blocking and wrote a class paper on it for Professor Ron Deibert. Deibert encouraged him to build out such software and hired him for what became the nonprofit OpenNet Initiative, which monitored censorship around the world. Then Villeneuve introduced Deibert to Laird. The two men had long talks about the technological, social, political, and business challenges of keeping the Internet as free as John Perry Barlow had declared it to be. They spoke about the need to get and publish objective, detailed information about what was happening inside routers and switches in hostile places. They agreed that the funding model for such a project had to be above reproach, so that it could not be accused of being in the pocket of an intelligence agency or a government. It would need to be able to get the word out to other researchers, the press, and the public, so that political pressure could be brought to bear on the implicated governments as well as companies, many of them based in the West, that provided the tools for censorship and spying. Some of our early interactions around hacktivism definitely were important to me in terms of setting up Citizen Lab, Deibert said. I was, like Laird, inspired by this hacking in the original sense of the word, combined with some political orientation or morality underneath it. I thought that was very appealing. I think we have the same outlook and philosophy about what's acceptable and not. Major research belonged at a university, Laird argued, because it prioritized scholarship over profit or politics. Like Tor in the practical sphere, a university could take in some government money, yet remain clean, as long as it declared its policies. It could also draw on those in multiple disciplines, computer and security experts, but also political scientists. It would take a tremendous leap in ambition, since many colleges still didn't even offer courses in security. In the spring of 2001, after receiving approval from the University of Toronto and an initial grant from the Ford Foundation, Deibert opened the Citizen Lab with Villeneuve as his first hire. The modest official mission, to study cyberspace in the context of international security, but the tools to be used ranged from technical exploration to field research to political theory. Almost immediately, the September 11th attacks multiplied the stakes. With U.S. intelligence agencies lambasted for not knowing enough, surveillance was bound to soar in the West as well as the East. And that was just the beginning. The geopolitics of the internet were metastasizing on their way to becoming one of the most significant and complex issues facing the world. It would be hard to find the answers, but no one would be in a better position to try. Early on, the lab looked hard at web filters in the Arab world, including their suppliers and what pages or words were restricted. As part of that long-running effort, it found that Syria was using software from Silicon Valley firm Bluecoat to spy on its people, potentially violating U.S. sanctions. The lab also took on the legal sale of exploits and other tools for what the industry calls lawful interception, tracking many cases where the vendors said they sold only to governments that respected human rights. Despite such claims, researchers often found repressive regimes deploying wares from companies like UK and Germany-based Gamma Group and Italian firm Hacking Team against human rights advocates, journalists, and minority party politicians. Much later, a devastating series of four front-page reports in the New York Times, driven by Citizen Lab findings, documented Israeli company NSO Group's Pegasus spyware being used against Mexican journalists, politicians, and others in Mexico, including officials investigating mass disappearances and even anti-obesity campaigners. Mexico's president ordered an investigation that the FBI concluded was a sham. Time and time again, the lab's independent academic structure gave it a way to write about what others could not. The university's review board had to approve research methods on ethical as well as legal grounds. All the same, the retired head of Canada's main intelligence agency once noted pointedly that some people thought Deibert should be arrested. As more countries turned to spying on each other over the net, using companies as stepping stones or knowing accomplices, untangling it all could have had political and business repercussions for any private researchers. The same big companies that excelled at examining and explaining malicious software that served organized crime shied away from being as clear when they realized that the culprits were the governments controlling major markets for their security software. Governments themselves stayed mum because the intelligence agencies maintained dominance over cyber offense and defense within the bureaucracy, and such agencies preferred not to reveal what they knew. Some specialized firms, such as Mandiant and CrowdStrike, disclosed more in private reports to clients, and they sometimes went public with accounts attributing infections in certain industries to coordinated campaigns by government-affiliated hacking groups. But they faced accusations of bias because their detection systems were only deployed in some countries. They had U.S. government contracts, or they had marketing reasons for publishing what they did. Moscow-based Kaspersky Lab likewise became the best in the world at ferreting out U.S.-sponsored cyber espionage campaigns, beginning with Stuxnet, the path-breaking weapon that defanged Iranian nuclear centrifuges before its exposure in 2010 opened everyone's eyes to the new era of cyber warfare. But Kaspersky found very little new to say about Russian malware. Citizen Lab could call things as it saw them, and it extended its reach by working with researchers inside other companies, including Google, who would have found it hard to publish under the name of their principal employer. The lab also worked with researchers at Amnesty International and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The lab's work only got better and more important as the years went on. One of Villeneuve's biggest projects was learning what spying was happening in Tibet. There was likely to be at least some, since activists were routinely stopped from entering China, at times arrested, and occasionally shown transcripts of their electronic chats with people inside China. They were risking their lives. Laird introduced the team to Greg Walton, who was still spending time in Dharamsala and working on Canadian-funded rights initiatives. Walton had good relations with the Tibetans, and Deibert hired him as a field researcher in 2008. For the first time, Deibert learned about targeted malware. Later, Walton got the Dalai Lama to agree to turn over the leadership's computers for study. Attackers had riddled those machines with compromises, but a hunch led to a big payoff. The network traffic from many of the machines included the same string of 22 characters, so Villeneuve Googled that string. In short order, he was on a machine in mainland China, looking at a portal listing hundreds of computers that same group had broken into. The victims included an email server for the Associated Press in Hong Kong, an unclassified computer at NATO headquarters, and embassies belonging to India, Pakistan, Germany, and Thailand. Diebert's team dubbed the spy network GhostNet. Citizen Lab disclosed it in 2009, making front pages around the world. Diebert had brought the New York Times in early, in part for maximum impact and in part as a hedge in case the Canadian government tried to suppress what the Citizen Lab had found. The first such account by a non-government agency and one of the first of any kind linking specific computer espionage to a world power, the GhostNet paper did not explicitly blame China. But that country was obviously behind this instance of what would become known as an advanced persistent threat, or a committed cyberspace adversary. Four servers controlled the penetrations, including one on the island of Hainan, home to the 3rd Technical Department of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. The team had worked feverishly to unwind all of the connections and document how they functioned. At the same time, the crew had wrestled with new issues about disclosure. If China had been found spying on a single identifiable person, they would have felt a responsibility to warn the victim, though there was no clear ethical rule on the matter. What if their own government was among the victims? What about other governments? Who should be told what and when? Rather than go directly to Canadian intelligence and risk being co-opted, Diebert went to the Canadian Computer Emergency Response Team as a courtesy. The Citizen Lab also asked the Canadian Foreign Affairs Ministry if it could pass along notifications to other countries. It took months for the ministry to even respond, and then it declined to help. Nathan Freitas, the hacktivist and Tor specialist helping Tibetans, had run into a similar problem. As reports shed light on Chinese spying, more people came looking for copies of what infected the Tibetans. "Malware we got hit with no one had ever seen before," Freitas said. Researchers came out of the woodwork saying, "Can we have a sample?" Some were academics looking for material for doctoral theses. Some were employees of private companies. Some were government officials. It was obvious that some were intelligence agents or contractors. "You can't fool yourself," Freitas realized. "This is global cybersecurity warfare." Rather than try to sort out who was working for whom and whether it would be appropriate to favor one country's emissaries over another's, Freitas threw up his hands. He decided to share samples only with the Citizen Lab, which had done the hard ethical reasoning. But in a community as heavily targeted as the Tibetans, with various Westerners helping out, some information inevitably went to the powerful Western agencies who were fighting the Chinese in many places. Hacktivism gave those operatives an excuse to be in and among the activists. For all of Diebert's careful ethical balancing, intelligence figures still involved themselves in the Citizen Lab's work. The lab got analytical help from Rafael Rohozinski, a lab research advisor who was wearing other hats at the same time. Rohozinski was CEO of Siphon Inc., a proxy network for evading censorship that the Citizen Lab had spun out. He also had worked in the military and as a technical advisor to the UN on telecommunications projects in former Soviet countries around the world. Though he described himself as an independent contractor, he acknowledged an intelligence background, and his affinities were clear. Laird and Villeneuve both called him a spook, which Rohozinski said was inaccurate. Laird also denies being a spy, and he never revealed himself as one to CDC. But his odd initial approach to the group, changing Hong Kong Blonde's backstory and later international work, have caused several in CDC to wonder, even without being aware of the intelligence relationships that have since come to light, Laird was close enough to the community that it may have regarded him, fairly or not, as an asset. Two of his intelligence contacts told me, "That's enough to change the history of hacktivism." Intelligence agencies ardently consumed information from the GhostNet effort. Rohozinski and Villeneuve briefed the NSA together, and Rohozinski learned more from Greg Walton directly. In some ways, Western intelligence agencies delighted at the Citizen Lab's work. It exposed a geopolitical rival, and it looked better because the lab had no ulterior motive. It also engaged in legal but invasive use of internet tools, such as port scanners, that would have required multiple levels of approval if some governments had used them directly. Yet Deibert detected hostility as well from the Canadian authorities he ran into, more than he could explain as professional jealousy or disdain for upstarts. Poring over the documents released by Edward Snowden a few years later, Deibert thought he realized why, and Rohozinski agreed. The Canadians had known about the Chinese spy network and had been piggybacking on it, collecting their own intelligence until the Citizen Lab blew the whistle. The year after the GhostNet report, Google said that the Chinese had hacked it as well, and that it was pulling out of the mainland as a result. Now everyone realized that they had been living in an undeclared cyber war. Google had among the best technical defenders anywhere. After Google realized the Chinese had gotten in and gone after the accounts of human rights advocates and Google's own code, it brought in the best outside minds it could find. That included Dave Attell and other NSA veterans, and even the NSA itself. The public was alarmed, but it never realized how effective the Chinese campaign really was, because no one had an incentive to admit it. According to Mudge, the Chinese had broken into repositories for the source code of many big companies and written in what looked like programming mistakes. In reality, they were backdoors that would allow Chinese spies to break into the customers of those big tech companies whenever they wanted. In a fight like that, Google and many others understandably considered the NSA to be the good guys. But it was not that simple. In a few years, with the public debut of NSA leaker Edward Snowden, Google and many other American tech companies, to say nothing of the rest of the world, would see the agency as an arch enemy. Chapter 10. Jake. After Hacktivismo's zero-bank browser helped drive the Tor project to broaden its mission in 2006, the service became truly useful to large numbers of people. Tor began spreading in earnest in countries like China and Iran, where surveillance could be swiftly followed by jail time. Siphon, Freegate, and other services could deliver forbidden parts of the web to readers, but only the souped-up Tor could both serve up such destinations and obscure who was reading them. Not coincidentally, U.S. government funding for the Tor project increased substantially that year. As with other free communication projects, the greater the take-up in areas ruled by figures both opposed to American interests and repressive to their own locals, the greater the U.S. enthusiasm for tools boosting free speech. But Tor's origins inside a Navy lab and its ongoing federal funding gave room for suspicions about whether it contained a hidden backdoor for U.S. spies or was otherwise corrupted, even though its source code was public for review. It was not, as Edward Snowden's documents would show years later. Tor frustrated U.S. intelligence agencies, which were unable to crack it reliably. Support from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and endorsements from public-minded cryptographers, including some on the Cypherpunks mailing list, helped convince many that they could trust Tor. But a majority of that crowd were of a previous generation. Long-haired mathematicians, more comfortable in a university library or the bowels of a Silicon Valley office park than hanging out with young activists. The apparent answer to Tor's public relations problem arrived in the person of Jacob Applebaum, known in person as Jake, and on Twitter as @IOError, a reference to a malfunction in input-output processing. Jake was young and good-looking, an engaging public speaker, and a frequent presenter at serious security conferences. He also had an extraordinarily compelling personal story. If many hackers turned to computers early to escape hard childhoods, Jake's case was extreme. His mother, a schizophrenic, raised him until she lost custody to an aunt, who left Jake in a group home. He went to his father at age 10, but the man grew addicted to heroin. Father and son lived on buses and in drug dens, and Jake once found his dad overdosing and near death. Returning to group homes, Jake dropped out of high school and taught himself to code, working for the likes of Greenpeace and the Rainforest Action Network. Jake met tour leaders Roger Dingledine and Nick Mathewson at a DEF CON and began volunteering. He joined a staff in 2008 and quickly became tour's most visible spokesman. He was also among the best traveled in tour's network, flying to hotspots around the world to teach locals how to use it. Wherever the attention was, it seemed Jake was there too, even as co-author of a research paper showing that one could recover plain text passwords by suddenly freezing a computer's RAM data storage. Pretty neat, Luke Benfey wrote when he successfully nominated Jake for Cult of the Dead Cow membership in 2008. He is certainly enthusiastic, Luke added, though a little bit weird. Most of the core CDC members at that point were impressed enough to support the motion, and Jake was in with Kevin Wheeler's final blessing. Even those who had not met him felt like they knew him because his story had been told by security, tech, and even some mainstream press outlets. There was an added attraction because the ranks of the group were thinning, and recruits with younger followers had to be prized if CDC, already more than 30 years old, could continue as a vital entity. Laird Brown had brought in Kamal Ackman, known as Mixter, and others through Hacktivismo, and old friends like Patrick Long Digital Krupa had joined. Some fresh security researchers like Adam O'Donnell also came aboard. But more were asking to be taken off the internal mailing list. That included both some of the technological powerhouses, busy running their own companies, and old-timers who were less technical, like Carrie Campbell. In 2006, she wrote with sadness and asked to go off the list, partly blaming herself for failing to get to know new members and drifting away. "I'm afraid my interests in the hacker scene have waned long ago. You new people don't know me. I was a 16-year-old girl when psychedelic warlord saw my crazy, poorly written teenage angst postings on his BBS and invited me to join CDC. I joined happily, honored, and proceeded to write crappy, horrific 16-year-old bloody T-files. I love the community of smart people and their girlfriends to converse with and bounce ideas off of. The acceptance of my female gender is extremely rare in the hacker scene, and I appreciate it. I never pretended to be a hacker, since I'm not skillful in that area, though social engineering came easily to me. Somehow I ended up purely by accident as the only girl in the world's most notorious hacker group. And while that was enormously amusing, I am now approaching 40 years old rapidly. I have no energy left for CDC or the mailing list. I do have energy for the wonderful friends I made throughout this, 21 or so year journey. Please do email me from time to time." Because she had been a core human connector within CDC and went back nearly as far as he did, Carrie's departure moved Kevin and made him worry that others would follow her. He took a long walk through Central Park, then wrote and asked the others to stay. "The hacker scene isn't something I'm into, other than as a recruiting pool for sharp motherfuckers, and a hearty hell yeah for being that," Kevin wrote. "Someday hopefully there'll be AIs in our mix, and we'll be trying to make practical sense of geopolitics and philanthropy. There's always more to say, more to point out, more that's fascinating and awesome and exciting. The universal, rock-solid, eternal part is the sharing, the communicating. Anyways, I want you guys to stick around." But the herd needed new blood. If Jake was as good as he seemed, he could bring not only new energy, but potentially more recruits. Jake soon gave some evidence of being a good bet. His press clippings were astonishing, including a 2010 Rolling Stone profile that called him a bizarro version of Mark Zuckerberg and the leading spreader of the gospel of anonymity. Inside CDC, Jake handled himself differently than the others, arguing more fiercely and sometimes with disdain for his elders. That accelerated after he hooked up with something even bigger than Tor: WikiLeaks. Activist hackers started the site in 2006 and first won wide attention in 2010 when they posted a video called Collateral Murder that captured the gunfire from a U.S. helicopter that killed a dozen people, including two Reuters journalists in Iraq. The video disproved U.S. claims the shooting was part of a battle. The one WikiLeaks founder who would be left standing after years of internal dissension and splits was Australian Julian Assange, who had nearly as bad a childhood as Jake, including hiding with his mother from a vengeful cult. Even more of a show-off than Jake, Assange had been a belligerently anti-establishment and sometimes malicious hacker in his native Australia. Under the name Prof, he had been on some of the most popular internet relay chat channels devoted to security and hacking in the 1990s, including #hack. He was an ambitious and dangerous hacker, later claiming credit for breaking into Australian government computers and backdooring the Pentagon. He was not remembered fondly by CDC, which saw him as an egotist who usually lurked instead of contributing to discussions. When he did speak up, it was often to criticize or ask for working code he could use to break into targets. Assange was also a regular presence on the Cypherpunks mailing list in 1996 and 1997, comparing notes with others about developments in cryptography and ongoing tensions with officials of many governments bent on restricting it. Assange advertised his own mailing list for legal aspects of computer crime as well, opening with a manifesto that declared computer crimes were being over-prosecuted and that intrusions should not be considered criminal acts unless they caused harm. At one point, he posted about a commercial spam operation and asked, "Who wants to take this site down first?" Assange and Mudd treated each other with respect, however, and met for dinner at the Chaos Computer Club's 2009 gathering in Germany before they aligned with opposite world powers. CDC admired much about the early WikiLeaks, with good reason. The site published a wide variety of documents and seemed most focused on government wrongdoing. When it obtained tens of thousands of U.S. State Department cables from then-private Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, in 2010, it worked with media partners that sifted through for important stories while not printing information that could lead to the deaths of those cooperating with American officials abroad. I have quite a few issues with the organization, but I like it more than I dislike it, at least for the time being, Laird wrote to the CDC list that year. Assange was to speak at the HOPE conference in New York in July 2010, but the Pentagon had labeled WikiLeaks as a threat, and Assange feared arrest. Jake appeared by surprise instead. He gave a fiery recounting of the whistleblowing site's history and courage, which he said continued the tradition of the Washington Post and the New York Times of Watergate and Vietnam coverage, before more recent timidity, such as the Times' year-long delay in exposing warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. "When the media is gagged, we refuse to be gagged," Jake said. He added that he wouldn't say anything about hacker Adrian Lamo, who had turned Manning into the authorities after the troubled private confided in him that he had leaked State Department cables. Then Jake unbuttoned his shirt and revealed a T-shirt underneath that read, "Stop Snitching." At the end of his talk, the room suddenly plunged into darkness, and the lights came up to show what appeared to be Jake being ushered out to safety. In reality, he was a body double, deployed in order to stop Jake from getting arrested or hurt, or simply to convince the audience that either was a possibility. The actual Jake had gone out the back. After that, American Customs and Border Patrol officers often stopped Jake at airports and interrogated him without charges. He complained vociferously in public and to his fellow CDC members, telling them in early 2011 that the U.S. government has flagged me just as the Nazis forced Jews to wear a gold star. "I don't have the choice of removing my marks, though. They're in the passport system for life." As someone who lived on the internet and credited it with saving him as a kid, Jake would have been aware of Godwin's Law. Named for its originator and EFF's first staff attorney, Mike Godwin, the aphorism states, "As an online discussion grows longer, the probability of a comparison involving Nazis or Hitler approaches one." Godwin was mourning both the declining quality of online discussion and the lack of gravity owed to the Holocaust. The old-timers in CDC were not impressed. "Dude, seriously?" Luke wrote. You just managed to pull off the elusive one-man Godwin. Jake, I think you need to have some understanding that you've made this bed, and now you have to lie in it. Prosecutor Glenn Kurzrock was more precise in referring to the rules governing U.S. Customs and Border Protection. It doesn't appear that CBP did anything wrong. They are entirely authorized to search and detain you when entering the country under the U.S. Code, including the contents of any electronic devices. Jake also sparred with the others repeatedly over Assange, whom Laird said was about as democratic in management style as the ruler of Saudi Arabia. So much for hacktivist solidarity, Jake complained. Luke and Kamal took a middle ground. Assange was an asshole, but he seemed to be doing good things. Broadly speaking, the State Department cables released by WikiLeaks showed U.S. officials doing their jobs. There was no great sinister conspiracy, but the various stories still embarrassed the American government and hurt diplomatic relations. The cables contained candid assessments of foreign heads of state, including their unsavory alliances and appetites for corruption. The anti-secrecy fervor at WikiLeaks stoked a rollicking debate inside CDC. Glenn and others saw Assange as reckless, noting that the judicial system and other parts of government have very good reasons for keeping some facts confidential. Arguing out a hypothetical about missile launch codes getting to the wrong hands, Jake declared, "Perhaps you shouldn't have missiles to launch if you can't keep your code secret." Jake said a lot of provocative things, declaring that wiretaps were entirely bogus and that most search warrants were improper. One of the most surprising assertions came in response to questions about who should decide what secrets to publish. Instead of WikiLeaks holding that right as a publisher, Jake said it was up to WikiLeaks' sources, whoever they were. "It's a rough reality, but bitching about WikiLeaks makes little to no sense," he wrote. "The point of the press is to inform." Members of Congress condemned WikiLeaks, and a federal criminal investigation put pressure on PayPal, Visa, and others that helped people donate to the website. The sprawling online activist group known as Anonymous then coordinated denial-of-service attacks on PayPal and Visa, effectively commandeering the mantle of hacktivism. The story of Anonymous, told more fully in books by anthropologist Gabriella Coleman and journalist Parmi Olsen, is fascinating and complex. It also owes a little of its culture to CDC. One of CDC's good friends and one-time web hoster, Tom Dell, had written software for Patrick Krupa's MindVox and then run Rotten.com, an early shock site that was a forerunner to 4chan. 4chan was mostly teenage boys chatting about pictures, and posts were labeled anonymous by default. But it had flashes of political action when core internet values, such as freedom of speech, were threatened. When the Church of Scientology tried to suppress publication of its secrets, 4chan users coordinated online and real-world protests, and the participants spun off as Anonymous. Subsequent targets included copyright enforcers such as the Motion Picture Association of America. From the beginning, corralling massive crowds in internet relay chat into something productive was extremely difficult. Organizers would peel off into secret smaller channels to thrash through priorities and then return to the larger gatherings to spread the word. Anyone could declare themselves a member of Anonymous, and any member could call for an operation, most commonly a denial-of-service attack. It was up to other members whether to participate in any of the operations. With the denial-of-service attacks, members were encouraged to download a tool that would let them participate. But while that let participants feel like they played an important role with little risk, neither conclusion was justified. Some were arrested because the tool did not hide their IP addresses, and most of the real firepower came from botnets, networks of captured machines controlled by a small subset of anonymous members. The regular members were helping to provide cover and confusion, and that was about it. As Anonymous allied with WikiLeaks and struck the payment sites with denial-of-service attacks, CDC members split on the ethics of the issue and opted to do nothing as a collective. Laird, who had been giving speeches for years on the ethics of hacktivism, carried the most weight on the subject. He opposed the denial-of-service attacks as censorship, arguing that the cure for bad speech is more speech. As reporters sought him out for comments about Anonymous, he stood firm. Luke, on the other hand, held that some denial of service attacks were reasonable civil disobedience, depending on the motives and targets. The onslaught only temporarily disabled PayPal and Visa while they shored up their defenses, he said. But knocking them briefly offline brought media attention and greater awareness of the issues involved. When the focus of crowds is one of the few things that can change policies, Luke felt, it made for a decent trade-off. Dozens of Anonymous members did have hacking skills, as became clear after I wrote a short 2011 story in the Financial Times about a researcher, Aaron Barr, who said he would give a conference talk about the people he believed led the group. Highly skilled Anonymous ringleaders had a private channel for communication, and after my story appeared, the members of that channel broke into the files of Barr and two affiliated companies, H.B. Gary Federal and H.B. Gary, in part to make sure he didn't have the goods on them. They published emails from the companies that showed that Barr was off the mark and that he was engaged in some questionable pursuits, including seeking a deal to discredit WikiLeaks by supplying faked information. The ace hackers announced themselves to the world as Lulz Security, began tweeting as @LulzSec, and went on a wild performance art run, hacking Rupert Murdoch's tabloids to post stories announcing his death, and even taking requests from their followers. LulzSec kept up a prolific and funny Twitter stream, largely manned by Topiary, later identified as 18-year-old Shetland Islands resident Jake Davis, and updated a webpage with a logo and the slogan, "Set sail for fail." In an Anonymous interview shortly before his arrest, Davis explained why he thought LulzSec had so much of the public behind it. "What we did was different from other hacking groups. We had an active Twitter controlled by me, cute cats and defaced messages, and a generally playful, cartoon-like aura to our operations. We knew when to start, we knew when to stop, and most of all, we knew how to have fun." Davis later said he had been inspired by UK satirist Chris Morris and comedian Noel Fielding, and that his playfulness had a serious point. He wanted people to wonder why major security failures were so common, instead of attributing all breaches to unstoppable geniuses. It was a mix of deliberate absurdity and a carefree childishness that was intended to alter the conversation to "these people are clearly just doing this as a game. Perhaps we should actually start thinking about security if these morons can wreak this much havoc." The stunts and public commentary echoed the back orifice performances. Davis had honed his writing by drafting entries for the satirical Inside Hackerdom site Encyclopedia Dramatica, which looked a bit like old-time CDC text files. In person, Davis was quiet and shy, quite like CDC founder Kevin Wheeler offstage. But the serious illegal acts put Lulz Security on a different path, and in any case, it would have lacked the stability of the Cult of the Dead Cow. That's because the members did not know each other in the physical world, so they could not make good decisions about trust. That problem was multiplied a thousandfold in Anonymous writ large. All the same, Anonymous and LulzSec launched a new era of stealing and publicizing material in a manner that was claimed to be for the public good. Many of the LulzSec capers were driven by both politics and entertainment value. Toward the end, after puzzling as CDC did about what to do with all the attention, Davis announced that LulzSec would revive AntiSec, an old campaign against white hat security professionals. This time, LulzSec would ally with the broader Anonymous and go after government security agencies, banks, and other establishment powers. Julian Assange was tracking events closely, at one point contacting the group for help getting into Icelandic email services that might show that government treating WikiLeaks unfairly. After LulzSec supporter Jeremy Hammond hacked U.S. intelligence consulting firm Stratfor, WikiLeaks published millions of Stratfor emails with clients. Eventually, authorities caught almost the entire LulzSec crew. Technological ringleader Hector Monsegur, alias Cebu, flipped and helped put Davis and the others away. After he began working undercover for the FBI in return for a radically reduced sentence, Monsegur encouraged hackers to disrupt more targets, and he repeatedly reached out to Assange and Jake, which suggests both were under U.S. investigation. The FBI was not the only agency to infiltrate Anonymous. Taking advantage of its loose structure, ordinary criminals used a group protest of Sony Corporation policies to break in and steal credit card numbers. Russia also had a substantial presence in Anonymous. In retrospect, it is interesting that some Anonymous members would later go on Moscow's payroll. One of them, Cassandra Fairbanks, moved from real-world Anonymous demonstrations to attending and writing about Black Lives Matter protests, to avidly supporting Bernie Sanders in the 2016 primaries. With more than 100,000 Twitter followers, she then took a job at the Russian propaganda outlet Sputnik and switched to full-throated support for Trump through the 2016 general election and afterward. Just before the November vote, she appeared on Alex Jones's YouTube conspiracy channel saying it was pretty likely that emails hacked from Hillary Clinton campaign chair John Podesta's Gmail account contained coded references to pedophilia. Monsegur liked to talk about his political work. He told journalists that he had hacked for a cause long before, protesting U.S. Navy test bombing in Puerto Rico, where his family had lived. He also claimed to have defaced Chinese websites in 2001, as other hacktivismo supporters did. Monsegur said he joined Anonymous as it fought PayPal and Visa and moved up from the cacophony of the main internet relay chat channel to more elite planning channels, including the one that morphed into LulzSec. The most impressive story. As part of Anonymous's Operation Tunisia, during the Arab Spring democratic uprisings, he personally defaced the webpage of the country's prime minister, who had approved mass hacking of citizens. But that and the other relatively high-minded feats proved impossible to confirm. Arthur Olson described the Tunisian defacement as Monsegur's work, citing him as the only source. Professor Gabriella Coleman, who was perceived as sympathetic, obtained chat logs and said Monsegur did not lead the team that performed the Tunisian defacing. In any case, even Monsegur's few remaining supporters would have to agree. He was an inveterate liar. His more prosaic crimes, such as stealing car parts and credit card numbers, were no mystery at all. Another core LulzSec member, 16-year-old Mustafa T-Flow Al-Bassam, an Iraqi refugee in London, did something more challenging than defacing a website. With help from a local Tunisian who got trick phishing emails from the government, Al-Bassam hacked into the server sending the emails and modified the malicious program they carried, quietly rendering it impotent. Like Monsegur's, Assange's judgment was soon called into doubt. Wanted for questioning in a Swedish probe of sexual misconduct, Assange lost a bid to avoid extradition and jumped bail in 2012, fleeing into Ecuador's embassy in London and remaining there. After Assange railed against his Swedish accusers from hiding, some of those inside CDC who had reserved judgment about him moved into the opposition. But as that furor grew and WikiLeaks increasingly focused on exposing U.S. secrets, Jake stayed the course. That loyalty built his stature as an information security rock star for those who remained believers in Assange. Within CDC, however, he caused more friction. Laird wrote to the private CDC email list that he was concerned about the departures of other WikiLeaks stalwarts fed up with Assange's dictatorial ways and grandstanding. That meant that the group depended on one man who was showing himself to be less and less dependable. I had heard that Assange had problems with women months before any of the Swedish thing became public, Laird wrote. Does Assange tone down his profile until the rape cloud is lifted? Hell no. He can't be in front of the press enough. So if he's convicted of some sort of sexual misdemeanor, this will, in my opinion, completely torpedo WikiLeaks. Jake came up firing, defending Assange as a visionary and dismissing the female complainants as fame-seeking. WikiLeaks' flagging reputation was one reason Edward Snowden did not turn to it with his documents in 2013, though Assange did later dispatch a colleague to spirit him from Hong Kong to Moscow and asylum. Inspired by John Perry Barlow's Independence Declaration, Snowden wore an Electronic Frontier Foundation sweatshirt on the job at the NSA. When he felt compelled to warn the world about what his agency had been doing, Snowden first reached out anonymously to a new EFF spinoff called the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which had been formed in support of WikiLeaks by Barlow, Pentagon Papers leaker Daniel Ellsberg, Boing Boing's Jenny Jardin, and a few EFF staffers. One of the staffers recommended Snowden get in touch with Freedom of the Press Foundation director Laura Poitras, who had been making a movie about WikiLeaks, and former Salon columnist Glenn Greenwald at the UK's Guardian. The Guardian published many of the most important revelations from Snowden's trove, but the pair also collaborated with other publications, including The Washington Post and The New York Times, to write up Snowden's disclosures. Jake later reported related stories for Der Spiegel in Germany, going further in exposing specific U.S. capabilities instead of broad practices. Though it was widely assumed the documents referred to in the stories came from Snowden, the information they contained has not been cited by The Guardian, New York Times, or Washington Post, which all had access to the main Snowden archives. That suggests a few possibilities. Der Spiegel may have had a different standard about what to publish. The material may have come from a second, still unknown source, or it may even have been obtained through hacks by the Russian government, which then leaked to Der Spiegel. Snowden showed how closely the U.S. government worked with and through American technology companies, sucking up domestic calling records, sifting through emails for specified content, and examining communications in other countries, which are not protected by the Constitution's prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. Google, for one, had not realized that the NSA was breaking into its properties overseas, and it moved swiftly to encrypt internal transfers of user data. Other stories showed that the NSA had continued to corrupt security products by paying for backdoors to be implanted, or by promoting standards that it knew it could break, such as the dual elliptic curve pseudo-random number generator. No major reforms passed Congress, and the anger in other countries hastened the balkanization of the Internet and sped up the introduction of nationalist technology policies that hurt U.S. providers to the detriment of populations everywhere. At the same time, the revelations intensified work on more secure alternatives. One of the most promising was Signal, developed by a team led by the brilliant anarchist and ex-hobo known as Moxie Marlinspike, and released in 2014. The Snowden disclosures carried enough force that Signal's end-to-end protocol became mainstream, even without most of its users' knowledge. The two founders of WhatsApp, an enormously popular messaging app for smartphones, were Jan Koum and Brian Acton. They sold the company to Facebook in early 2014 for $19 billion and stayed to run it with some independence. Koum belonged to the long-running hacking group WooWoo, which included CDC's Adam O'Donnell and such CDC friends as Doug Song. Song urged Koum to get in touch with Marlinspike, and Koum agreed when Acton proposed having WhatsApp adopt the nonprofit Signal's open-source technology, protecting a billion people from mass surveillance. In 2018, Acton would donate $50 million to create a new foundation to spread Signal much further and sign on as executive chairman, citing the opportunity to make a meaningful contribution to society by building sustainable technology that respects users and does not rely on the commoditization of personal data. Later, he said he had been motivated by an increase in requests from law enforcement and the desire to render those requests useless. Koum stayed on at Facebook, where he was one of only three executives also serving on the company's board. Though he continued to run WhatsApp, Facebook began demanding more data than expected about WhatsApp users, building up ad revenue, but also exposing the users to greater corporate and government scrutiny. Koum would quit in mid-2018. Jake moved to Germany in 2012 and spent more time promoting Tor than he did coding for it. He attached his name to security research on other issues that drew wide attention. But some co-authors later complained that he had asked to be added so that he could use his fame to promote the work. Jake flouted his edginess in multiple ways, including boasting of his past work for San Francisco bondage porn site kink.com and sexually propositioning people at first meeting, even in professional contexts. He bragged of multiple lovers and had relationships with filmmaker Laura Poitras, who later acknowledged that he had mistreated a friend of hers, as well as Boing Boing's Jenny Jardin, a friend to several in CDC. Jake spoke of waking up in bed with Assange and two women, and he attended private sex parties, less rare in hacker culture than elsewhere. Even there, he pushed past the norms of the environment. One of his techniques in pursuing sex from someone who might otherwise object was to begin transgressive behavior in front of another senior hacker, said longtime friend Andy Isaacson. That hacker, not wanting to burn a relationship, would not object. This in turn put more pressure on the prey, who was more likely to assume that Jake was following norms in the situation, or would have a witness on his side if not. Jake's magnificent gifts overlap with the same fundamentals as his failure. He's very intelligent and he doesn't let things go, said Isaacson. A key lesson from the experience, he said, is that abusers can use loose organizations as hunting grounds. As a champion social engineer, Jake exploited his role as a gateway to hacker prominence, victims said, leading many to conclude they would be frozen out if they objected. He targeted more junior people in the Tor community, where complaints led to a 10-day suspension for suspected harassment in the spring of 2015. That did not dissuade him. Fortunately, longtime EFF head Shari Steele took over as Tor executive director later that year, bringing more responsive leadership. Steele came too late for some, including a young engineer named Chelsea Comlow, who had gravitated toward security after hearing Jake speak at her company about Snowden's leaks. Comlow traveled to Hamburg for the Chaos Computer Congress in December 2015 and went to Berlin with others after to socialize. At Jake's apartment the night of January 1st, she blacked out and woke to realize Jake was having sex with her without consent. Earlier, she had refused his repeated requests to have sex in front of and with others, but both of those things occurred. Back home and upset, she confided in people who knew other victims, and she got in touch with them. Steele's arrival at Tor gave them hope that change was possible. To protect themselves and warn others, they went to Steele and also prepared a website where they told their stories of assault and coercion under pseudonyms. For me, it was really important that new people entering the community not have what happened to me happen to them, Comlow said. Jake resigned on Thursday, June 2, 2016, but Tor gave no reason in its announcement. Only after the anonymous website went live the next day did Steele acknowledge, on Saturday, that concrete sexual assault allegations and an investigation were behind Jake's departure. At various times over the next year and a half, some victims identified themselves, including Comlow and Lee Honeywell, a Canadian security engineer for big tech companies. Honeywell said that during an on-and-off consensual relationship a decade earlier, Jake had ignored a safe word and become violent. Being involved with him was a steady stream of humiliations, small and large, Honeywell wrote on her own site. He mistreated me in front of others and overshared about our intimate interactions with friends, who were often also professional colleagues. Without criminal charges, Jake fought back, in part through media connections, who cast doubt on some of the anecdotes. He denied the worst accusations, threatened legal action against the women, and implied that the attacks against him stemmed from his work for free speech and secure technology. Still more people came forward, and the weight of evidence against him grew. Tor handled it in a way that you would hope and expect, Comlow said. Comlow was invited to a Tor conference the next year, began writing code for the project, and later was designated a core contributor. That was especially encouraging, Kamlo said, because of the male dominance in the field, and because women are more likely to be abused by men who spy on them. Security and privacy is a great field for women, because there is a lot of moral reasoning, and you are in it because you want to protect people, and that should be something that resonates with not just straight white men. The Tor project replaced its entire board. Even Jake's mentor, Roger Dingledine and Nick Mathewson, stepped down while remaining lead employees. People involved in the process said that the prior regime had had a leadership vacuum and consistently played down what many people told them about Jake. What you tolerate and don't tolerate defines you, one of them said. New directors included the EFF's Cindy Cohn, cryptography experts Bruce Schneier and Matt Blaze, and Gabriella Coleman, the anthropologist who chronicled Anonymous. After a few days, Barlow's Freedom of the Press Foundation, which by now had added Snowden to its board, dropped Jake as an unpaid advisor. Noisebridge, a warehouse-sized San Francisco hackerspace Jake had co-founded, said he could not come back. Jake's early defenders included some Tor node operators, EFF co-founder John Gilmore, and Daniel J. Bernstein, an anti-government cryptographer who had helped loosen export rules with Cohn's legal help years before. Most cautioned against rushing to judgment without legal process. Now a professor in the Netherlands and a major figure in spreading non-NSA-backed encryption, Bernstein kept Jake on as a graduate student. The revelations were especially painful for CDC, which had built Jake's credibility with other hackers. His conduct underscored the male domination in security generally, and in the hacker social scene in particular. Worst, Jake embodied the dark side of CDC's formula, wielding a media-savvy, boundary-flaunting personality that could drive awareness while also feeding a rapacious ego. What had made CDC special was shared values despite different viewpoints and areas of expertise, and that had been shattered. Those of us who knew Julian back in the day always knew he was kind of a shit. I personally was always dubious of WikiLeaks largely because of that, Paul Leonard said. The reasoning all goes back to the core of CDC, and furthermore, was why Jake Applebaum hit us in an unreasonably painful way, which is that, to an extent, CDC functioned as something akin to a family unit. CDC could have said nothing. It was not as famous as it had been a decade earlier, and many of the articles about Jake wouldn't mention his affiliation with it. To the group's credit, its far-flung members scrambled even before the anonymous website appeared or Tor elaborated on its one-sentence announcement of Jake's resignation. Jake was still on the CDC mailing list, so the discussions had to happen elsewhere, including in smaller email chains. Luke alerted Kevin and Laird to early references on Twitter about rape accusations. Christian Ryu also wrote to Misha Kubeka. The concern was followed by caution. It's bad news, but I would definitely want to see more evidence than just some random dudes on Twitter before we took any action internally, Luke wrote. Misha spoke from the gut. Fuck, what is up with WikiLeaks people and rape? After Christian spotted the anonymous accuser's website and passed along the link, Laird weighed in Saturday morning, saying that he had known that women had been trying to gather evidence of rape against Jake, and that he had heard some unsavory stories of sexual conquests. He can be a complete dick, Laird wrote. I have my own experiences with this when I hosted him in India and he pulled some dumb stunts. Luke added Adam O'Donnell to the thread and suggested they seek out Jake's side of the mess. The news story started showing up on Sunday, and a friend of the group, Nick Farr, wrote publicly about being threatened by Jake and his supporters. That happened after Farr obliged Jake's demand that he cancel a 5-minute talk during the Chaos Computer Congress's open mic session by someone claiming that Jake was a U.S. intelligence plant. Farr refused to hand his correspondence with the would-be speaker over to Jake. Every night I came back to my hotel room, a typewritten note on my pillow stating, "Don't make us use extreme measures," handed all over. Farr said he contacted people he thought he could trust to explain what he was doing, but they all told him to find a compromise. You can't dialogue with a sociopath, Farr wrote. What's worse is when people you consider your trusted friends take the sociopath's side. That was enough to push Laird toward making a public statement, and Adam seconded. Without having heard back from Kevin, Luke asked Misha to remove Jake from the mailing list so that they could out a proposed decision and statement to the full group. Finally, late Sunday night, Kevin showed up and said he wanted to quietly remove every trace of Jake from CDC sites, including the alumni roster. "I'm very sorry for my part in accepting this guy. That was dumb," Kevin wrote. "What I've come to realize is that personality matters 100% more than skills for this stuff. Whether any of these allegations are true or not, he doesn't fit in with us." The group convinced Kevin that they needed a public distancing. They collaborated on what would be its most serious public statement in more than a decade, then posted it to the CDC homepage and to the then-open CDC Facebook group, where many of the members and fans shared information. "Like much of the hacker community, we were troubled to hear the allegations of sexual abuse, manipulation, and bullying leveled against one of our members, Jacob Applebaum, a.k.a. IO Error," it began. "We're also aware that the Tor Project is conducting an internal investigation and encourage anyone with relevant testimony to come forward. For some, it won't be easy. There can be shaming or humiliation, or the fear of not being believed. It is also our responsibility to create an environment where people feel safe to come forward. We have always stood for freedom of speech and expression, which sometimes necessitates the right to anonymity. This is something that victims of abuse often require. We stand by their right to be anonymous. Others, like our friend Nick Farr, who decided to go public with his own difficulties, deserve our respect and support. Everyone will do this in their own way. We know that it may be scary, but we also encourage victims to contact their appropriate local authorities. We understand the complicated relationship we all have with law enforcement, but there is a time and place for government intervention. If the most extreme of these allegations are true, they should be addressed in a court of law and dealt with appropriately. Cult of the Dead Cow is known for a lot of things, but treating people horribly is not one of them. If communities are to thrive and remain relevant, we have to do some house cleaning from time to time. As we have become aware of the anonymous accusations of sexual assault, as well as the stories told by individuals we know and trust, we've decided to remove Jake from the herd, effective immediately. In a personal post on Medium, Laird said he hoped the ouster would help educate others about systemic sexism and hackerdom. Exacerbated by a tendency toward rule-breaking, distrust of legal authorities and reporting transgressions, and some excessive scenesterism. There's been a lot of looking the other way in the hacker community when powerful people overstep the bounds, and that has to stop. It didn't take long for that wish to start coming true, as the broader anti-harassment movement known as #MeToo built up steam in the fall of 2017. The hacker community rose up against other accused predators. Even Cap'n Crunch, John Draper, who had haunted hacker cons from the days of HoHoCon, was finally outed for pursuing underage boys and banned from gatherings. A Draper spokeswoman denied his seeking sex. At least Jake was gone from CDC before the election of 2016, when his association with WikiLeaks would have been indefensible to everyone in CDC. WikiLeaks would be a central partisan player in helping elect Trump, who lavishly praised it on the campaign trail. Emails stolen from the Democratic National Committee by Russian operatives were gleefully published by WikiLeaks as the Democratic Convention was getting underway, when they could be dumped with maximum impact. Hours after Trump's campaign was blown off course by the publication of a video in which he bragged of grabbing women by the pussy, WikiLeaks muddied the day by beginning to roll out stolen emails from Clinton campaign chairman Podesta. Long-promised leaks about Russia, meanwhile, never materialized, and Assange repeatedly tried to throw off suspicions with misinformation, denying that Russia was a source and hinting that a DNC staffer was one. In the summer of 2018, the special counsel's indictment of 12 Russian military intelligence officers would quote the emails between WikiLeaks and its real source, a Russian-created persona calling itself Guccifer II. Jake and Assange were far from alone in draping themselves in morality while serving other causes. Instead, they were just the most prominent exemplars. From 2016 on, a substantial amount of purported hacktivism would be something else in disguise.